This is Law and Disorder.
To celebrate May Day, we'll be having a roundtable discussion with special guests, Zaid Dorn, Stanley Aronowitz, and Annette Rubenstein.
How did May Day start? And what happened to it in the United States? First, they made a Labor Day instead of a May Day, sometime in September, and then they renamed May Day Law Day, all about what the United States has done to its working class. Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th. Today's May 1st, as all of you know, and as some of you may know, it's also May Day. It's not just an ancient pagan holiday. It actually is an international holiday for workers. And moreover, it was a holiday that was founded right here in the United States in Chicago. We have some special guests for you today to talk about our May Day show. We have playwright Zaid Dorn, who wrote the acclaimed play, and I can say I acclaimed it myself because I saw it here in New York, called Haymarket. Welcome to the show, Zaid Dorn.
Thank you.
We have Annette Rubenstein. Annette has been celebrating May Day for 96 years. Well, I don't think she was that conscious the first couple of years, but I'll bet you she's been celebrated for a good 90. Annette was 96 years old a couple of days ago. We want to wish her a happy birthday and welcome her to Law and Disorder, Annette Rubenstein. Welcome, Annette. For our listeners, many of you probably know of her. Annette is a literary historian. She wrote two fine books on American literature and English literature. I should say as an aside, our co-host Michael Ratner's son, Jake, was 18 years old last week. He's off to college next year. And for a birthday present, I sent him your two-volume work on American literature, Root and Branch, that goes up to 1955. And I remember when you were in China years ago and lectured on that subject, and the book was actually printed in China. I bought a number of copies years ago for young people in my life, and the latest one I've given to is Jake Ratner. So on his behalf, I say thank you. Annette was a principal here in the New York City school system in the 30s. Because she was a socialist, she lost her job. She became the office manager for the great radical congressman from Harlem, Vito Marcantonio. Back in those days, there were Labor Day and May Day demonstrations. We're going to get a chance to talk about that. Annette is active to this minute. She's a teacher for the Brecht Forum. She's an editor at the magazine Science Society and a contributor to Monthly Review. So she's a very special guest indeed. Last, we have the organizer of the Left Forum, Julie Rubin. Let me start off with you, Zaid Dorn. The massacre in Chicago a couple of days after the great May Day demonstration, somewhat of the subject matter of your play. I know that the May Day holiday was first celebrated in Chicago, and it was movement for the 8-hour day, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. The original, in 1886, people were demonstrating for the 8-hour day, Chicago socialists and anarchists. May 1st, 1886, Albert Parsons and Lucy Parsons, who were leading anarchists of the day, led a crowd of 80,000 people up Michigan Avenue in Chicago demonstrating for the 8-hour day. And of course, it was only 3 days later that the bomb was thrown in the Haymarket, led to the great Haymarket trial, which the commemoration of which led to May Day.
May Day, after that, was celebrated for some time in the United States, and then I think it went into eclipse when the anti-communist witch hunters in the 50s changed it into what they call Law Day. Here on Law and Disorder, we call it May Day. Do you remember, Annette, the first time you participated in a May Day event?
Yes, it was just about 53 years ago. It was 1933, I think, was the first time that I marched on May Day. I think it was about 53 years ago was the first time I marched in May Day, 1933. And we had enormous May Day marches then and would always end up in Union Square. Louis Weinstock of the Painters Union was chairman of most of the May Days. And I don't think most of us really listened to the speeches very much. It was a time that you met people that you hadn't seen. You'd been working in different departments, and you met people that you hadn't seen for some time. And also, you were very busy calculating how many more people there were this year than there had been last year, because the May Days kept increasing in size throughout the 30s, and we really had very enormous marches there. We'd meet at different points in the city, and usually unions would meet together and then march down to the Union Square.
What sort of demands did the marchers make?
Well, they were topical demands. A good deal of it was an increase in the relief, later WPA, that we were very much concerned with. And the various unions might be having individual struggles that we would also, that was the building and the CIO at that time. So we'd have representatives from different places out west, mostly the steel workers, auto workers, and so on. Toward the end of the 30s, you began to have a great many on civil rights, a great many black representatives, never very much black attendance, actually. And actually, you had also, it was a family thing. People would bring children, and you'd have buggies and things of that kind that they would be having there, and dogs, too. It was really very much of a holiday of that kind. throughout the 30s, it was a very cheerful time. The things I remember most specifically are the later ones when we had a good deal of heckling after 49, 50, after the Waldorf conference, where you began to have a great deal of trouble. And the parochial schools would give their students a holiday, deliberately telling them to go and heckle the marches. I remember one time I was setting the had a very, very loud voice at the time. I could have been an auctioneer. And I was setting the slogans for the teachers' group that was marching with, and these kids throwing things and so on. And I started the slogan, "No more homework, build swimming pools," which was a demand of the teachers' union at the time. And you had a sudden surprise with a student. Another similar incident, and also of the 50s, my mother was marching with me at the time, and there had just been a referendum about an increase in pay for policemen. And there were a number of rather unfriendly policemen, a great many police around. And my mother said to the captain of the police, "You see this crowd here? Every single one of them voted for a pay increase for you." He said, "Is that a fact?" "Yes, it is." So we saw him telling the other police about that, and they looked much more friendly.
Zaid Dorn, can you tell us what happened to the demand for the eight-hour day back in 1886? How many hours were workers working then? How successful was that demand?
Well, they were working, 12 to 14 hours at the time. After the bombing at the Haymarket, just like with the 40s and 50s later that drove May Day underground, the demand for the eight-hour day was driven underground for quite some time. I mean, after the police were killed at the Haymarket, the labor movement was tarred as, terrorists and anarchists, and it was a while before it became a demand that could be articulated again, but of course eventually they did succeed, and 10, 15 years later people did get the eight-hour day.
And people did better probably up until maybe 20 years ago or so. I think now demand for the eight-hour day is probably relevant again, isn't it?
The way it's working now with temporary hires and, part-time workers and the move away from full-time, benefits, corporations more and more trying to kind of scale back the requirement of kind of an eight-hour day and a living wage, which was really the fundamental point of the whole demonstration.
It was 8 hours of work and 8 hours of sleep and 8 hours as do as you may, I think.
Absolutely.
Was the slogan.
Yep.
Annette, can you tell us what your feelings are with respect to the immigrant movement that I understand is not only exploded on the American political scene, and these are immigrant workers. How do you assess that?
Well, I think probably in the countries that the immigrants come from, May Day has kept alive, much more so than here in the United States. I taught in a number of the socialist countries during the 60s and 70s and early 80s in Hungary, late German Democratic Republic, Czechoslovakia, and so on. And there, they all celebrated May Day very seriously. It was a big holiday. It had not been in the United States for some time. And one unsung hero of May Day was Governor Altgeld, who really sacrificed his political career to pardon the last of the Haymarket people who were in jail then. Sorry that there's not been more about Altgeld. I haven't seen the play yet, but I hoped it was there.
Yeah, Altgeld was the governor of Illinois at the time. He was also a friend of Clarence Darrow, the great anti-death penalty litigator in those days. We like to think of him as the Bill Kunstler of his time. Bill Kunstler, I know, was a friend of yours, Annette. You were involved with him in the Harlem Six.
Yes, Bill Kunstler was a very close friend. The first pro bono that he took was the Harlem Six, which was a case we were working on at the time.
We very much admired him. And, we start our show off with a sentiment that he often expressed when he spoke, and that's that civil liberties don't disappear overnight. It comes piece by piece, piece by piece. That's what we're all observing now, of course.
One question. Did we talk yet about the change in this country from May Day to Law Day?
Yeah, well, we didn't pay very much attention to that change because by that time the May Days were not as large or as important as they had been. They were petering out.
Do you know what year the transition took place? Certainly no, for 20 years or so at least. I mean, when I think about it, I think, you know, Lord Day, of course, they did it purposely, I think. Yeah. Obviously, they called it Lord Day because their idea was basically people shouldn't demonstrate or fight for their rights in the streets.
Right.
So that's why they called it Lord Day. Of course, now it has another meaning as the government is violating the law every day.
Yeah, it's a great irony, I think, that May Day, you know, originated in America, and then, as Annette was saying, it's so much more legitimate in every other country in the world, I think, taken so much more seriously, and the labor movements there are taken so much more seriously. I was just in Paris during these student demonstrations, and it's just amazing to see how much people in other countries identify themselves as workers in a way that people here just don't. And you know, the idea of a May Day, a Labor Day, a Workers' Day is just so important in other places.
Even the change from May Day to Law Day, but prior to that, they already had taken away May Day as Labor Day. That's in September now, Labor Day.
Yeah.
First, they evaporated any of the meaning out of May Day, and then they actually tried to go contrary to it.
You know, and the irony is, of course, that it first initiated here in the United States. The double irony is that International Women's Day, which came out of a largely women's textile strike in New York City in 1919, I think.
National Women's Day was also very much celebrated in all of the socialist countries where I was teaching. And in the GDR, it was the only time I ever saw anyone drunk, because every time a woman came into the office, you would drink a toast to her. And the toast piled up. Actually, we were much more conscious of the attempt to emphasize Labor Day. Law Day never made much of an impression on the people I knew. But the government did build up Labor Day in order to distract from May Day.
Yeah, a non-militant workers' holiday.
Zaid, I wanted to just pick up on what you said about the relative real lack of class consciousness in this country, that working people don't see themselves really as workers. And there's a corresponding lack of organization, so that in the countries that celebrate May Day, you have socialist parties, you have labor parties, you have workers who quite consciously know their interests are separate and opposed to the people who they work for, and they try to organize themselves politically. But you don't yet have that here, do you?
You don't have it at all, and it's a really, I think part of it is that most Americans think that we've already had our revolution and that they don't need one. That's one reason. But it really is extraordinary, the lack of class consciousness here. I remember when I came back from teaching the GDR, and I happened to be telling an incident that my student secretary had gotten me first class tickets, and I didn't want to ride in the first class car because there was nobody in it, and I wanted to talk to people in Germany. I could. And so I'd move, and the conductors were very distracted and very unhappy, being Germans, at seeing someone with a first class ticket in a second class car. And when I was telling this to a group of people, we'd gone to theater for three couples and told them this. One of them, a very intelligent, not a communist as we were, but left liberal at least, said, "Oh, you mean they still have class cars in the GDR? We don't even have that in the United States." And I said, "We certainly do. We have the smoking luxury car and the ordinary." "Oh, but that's just a matter of money, not a matter of class."
That's
fact that money means class was something that most workers don't understand at all.
Yeah.
When Roosevelt tried to make a $100,000 income a top limit, you had the most extraordinary people who were making $15 a week saying that that's not fair to try to limit the income up there.
I mean, Roosevelt actually tried to limit what people could make?
Yeah.
At $100,000.
Roosevelt tried to set it a top income that nobody could make more, that it would be taxed after that. It would be 100%
tax. The tax would be 100%. Amazing. Well, we've certainly gone the other way.
Yeah. Well, I'll say the CEOs now of major corporations, some of them make more than 1,000 times what their workers make. The income differential lately is just
And the
really
biggest
extreme.
Differential in any country in the world is ours.
Yeah, and I also think that, you know, that in terms of class consciousness in America, part of the reason it doesn't exist is because of the myth of the American middle class. I've always been amazed. You first as a student and then as a teacher, I've been around several times when a teacher has asked a group of young people, how many of you are middle class? And invariably, every single hand goes up. And you'd think there's no ruling class, there's no working class, it's just all in the middle, which is, of course, why politicians end up targeting all of their proposals to the middle class, as though that's all of us.
Of the top 10 industrialized so-called democracies in the world, European countries, Canada, Israel, United States, Australia, the United States is absolutely the bottom in terms of the poverty level of most working people here. But nonetheless, they persist in thinking of themselves as middle class. You know, I guess there's some historical reasons for it. There was the constant influx of immigrants so that people kept stepping up. And there was the gateway to the West, and there was free land for a while. And there was a revolution here that gave at least white males the vote, and there was no feudal aristocracy, landowning aristocracy here. But I think all that has changed, and that this is really a class-stratified society, a society of real permanent classes. You don't enter the upper class anymore. Maybe the last chance you had to do that was around the time of the Civil War. Are pessimistic of the intellect, but you try to be optimistic of the spirit. My hope is that this new immigrant busting out all over the country is going to light a fire under some other people, say the same way the civil rights movement was the engine for so many other subsequent struggles.
Now, Annette, did you know a lot of people who actually met their spouses at May Day? I know a lot of people who, they went to May Day. It was a great spot to meet husbands or wives. Everybody was progressive who was there.
Oh, yes, you had, and children. You had the youngsters there, and even those in carriages and so on. It was a holiday kind of thing, especially in the 30s.
Yeah, that's when I know a lot of people who met in the 30s.
You had the feeling that it was really a national holiday practically.
Now, can you go, you mentioned something when you were talking about the Waldorf.
1949-50, the big international Waldorf conference that we had. I was not a socialist, I was a communist.
What was that, the Waldorf?
That was a international thing. Paul Robeson, of course, was there, and a great many others. And we had delegates from practically every country, very large ones from the socialist countries, and a great many panels, literary, dramatic and so on, and a good deal of opposition here. And that was the first time, I think, that we really were outnumbered by an unfriendly picket line. Until then, it had been the majority, at least in this.
Where did it actually take place?
At the Waldorf Astoria.
Oh, really?
That's why it was called the Waldorf Conference.
Outnumbered, how many pickets, for example?
Well, there was a tremendous large picket. You had... We didn't know it was the Christian Front there, but it was the beginnings of that. And unfortunately, you had a great many well-known literary people like Robert Lowell and others who were...
Robert Lowell?
Yeah. Because the beginning of news about Stalin was coming out then. Most of us had not known it before, and that was the heckling point for an intellectual like Robert Lowell. But you had almost every panel, you had certain disruptors like that, and it was really the beginning of the McCarthy period, as it was called then.
Now, what was the year that Peekskill happened with Robeson? Was that right around then when there was a...
Peekskill
48, right?
These things in the last 50 years really begin to run together as far as dates go, as far as I'm concerned.
And we also, when you were talking, both you mentioned Governor Altgeld, and I don't know, Zaid, would you ever really examine what happened with Altgeld at the end when you were doing your play?
Yeah, I mean, it's not in the play itself, but I mean, I read a lot about it. And of course, as Annette said, I mean, Altgeld put his career on the line, and his political career was eventually destroyed because of pardoning the Haymarket Eight. And of course, in a certain
way, who did he pardon? Everybody?
He pardoned all of them, except, of course, it was too late for the four who had been executed, and even for the four who had spent, you know, a decade or more in jail.
And he was governor at the time, and then he tried to run again, and
And he was defeated. His opponent characterized him as an anarchist sympathizer for pardoning them, even though, of course, Altgeld didn't personally have anarchist sympathies. He was just interested in the fact that the Haymarket trial had been an outrageous miscarriage of justice.
We'd like to announce a special May Day event. Zaid, can you tell us a little bit about this, the dramas of Haymarket?
Yeah, we're having a conference today, a panel on Haymarket, and it is going to be me and Martin Duberman, the novelist who's written a novel about Haymarket, and Jim Green, the labor historian, who's written a really fantastic new history of Haymarket. And it's a panel at Columbia this afternoon, and it's about narrative approaches to talking about a historical event, and it's, of course, about Haymarket and how we can approach Haymarket today, how it has relevance for us.
Is that open to the public?
Yes, it is.
At 2:45 p.m.?
Mm-hmm.
Learner E568.
Right, at Columbia University.
Great.
Mm-hmm. Julie Rubin, what's your feeling with respect to the traditions of May Day and the immigrant demonstrations that have been going on?
Well, I think the immigrant demonstrations are precipitated by something other than May Day, but the character of them is very much a character of a workers' demonstration. People identify themselves as workers and want rights as workers in this country. And that was very clear in the one I went to on Monday in New York, a week ago Monday. People had signs in Spanish that said, "These hands are not the hands of criminals, they raise your children," or "These hands grow your food." And that's very important, and people identify themselves as workers. I met a man from Senegal who said, "We are good people, we are good workers." So my hope is that this grassroots immigrant demonstration for civil rights will spawn a new resurgence of the left, which will make alliances with the labor movement, which is in terrible straits right now, and push for a living wage across the board, and workers' rights and international workers' rights. A lot of these people said, "We're not in this country because we want to be. We're in this country because we need the work."
Yeah, they're from countries so assaulted under the U.S. economic gun that they've really been driven here, really from pillar to post, because now they're being told they're not wanted here. They're going to be criminalized. People really have nowhere to go, and it's not their fault.
We just spoke with Annette Rubinstein, Zaid Dorn, and Julie Rubin on May Day.
Pa' una ciudad del norte yo me fui a trabajar. Mi vida la dejé entre Ceuta y Gibraltar. Soy una raya en el mar, fantasma en la ciudad. Mi vida va prohibida, dice la autoridad. Solo voy con mi pena, sola va mi condena. Correré mi destino por no llevar papel, perdido en el corazón de la grande Babilón. Me dicen el clandestino, yo soy el quebra ley. Mano negra clandestina, peruano clandestino, africano clandestino, marihuana ilegal. Solo voy con mi pena, sola va mi condena. Correré mi destino para burlar la ley. Perdido en el corazón de la grande Babilón. Me dicen el clandestino por no llevar papel. Argelino clandestino, nigeriano clandestino, boliviano clandestino, mano negra ilegal.
I'd like to introduce our next guest, Stanley Aronowitz, special guest on our May Day show. Stanley Aronowitz is a distinguished professor of sociology at the City University of New York. He's a writer. He's written 29 books. He's a union organizer. He's still a delegate from his union at the university. And Stanley is going to talk to us about what perspective we might have in building our own party in answer to the kind of things that May Day stands for. Stanley Aronowitz, welcome to Law and Disorder. I want to read you the populist preamble to its 1892 program. I think it remains as relevant today as it was back in 1892. Let me read it to you and ask for your response. "We meet in the midst of a nation brought to the verge of moral, political, and material ruin. Corruption dominates the ballot box, the legislatures, the Congress, and touches even the ermine of the bench. The fruits of the toil of millions are boldly stolen to build up colossal fortunes for a few, unprecedented in the history of mankind, and the possessors of these, in turn, despise the Republic and endanger liberty. Stanley Aronowitz, how do you think things stand today with respect to those sentiments of 1892?
I think they're worse.
Even worse, huh?
The difference is that in 1892, you had a populist party that was contesting power with the Democrats and the Republicans. The Democrats and the Republicans sung to the same master's tune, and the populists, which were largely an agrarian party but did have some urban base, was trying to say, look, you cannot rely on the two-party system because they're in the pockets of the plutocrats, of the rich, of the well-born, of the people who are actually making all the money and concentrating all the wealth. We don't have a situation like that now. What we have now is people demonstrating against the war, and they're demonstrating for immigrant rights, and all of that is terribly important, and I'm not going to say one word against it. The major problem, however, is that we do not have a political force, whether it be electoral or non-electoral, that actually calls the tune on a whole different set of alternatives and has a whole different attitude towards what can be done in America. That's really the basic difference. If we had a political force, a party, that actually called different issues and connected them one to the other and connected them especially to class exploitation and class oppression, that took an unvarnished position of class and class struggle, we would have a very different political environment in this country.
No, I think that's great, Stanley. I mean, what you're saying is really right. I mean, whether there's people against the war, there's people against torture, there's people about Katrina, but there's no connections being made and there's no party to push it.
That's correct.
I mean, I think that's right.
We have a lot of people now who call themselves anarchists, and they're all in these movements, but the problem is even the anarchists in 1892 had a political organization, and they had their own press, and they had their own voice. We don't have a voice that does these kinds of things. Now, the problem that we have now is that we are about to see the passage of an immigration bill. I just saw the Democratic Leadership Council statement, and they're very happy that we're going to strengthen our border security. They're going to give the immigrants a chance to get to be citizens, and they have to go through hoops to get that. And they're going to basically use the immigration bill probably to initiate a guest worker program.
It's really disgusting.
And that Democratic Leadership Council.
It's incredible.
This is not the Republican Party. We're talking, and who are the people behind that? Well, John McCain for the Republicans and Ted Kennedy for the Democrats.
Yeah, people say, I saw that Kennedy was out there. It's really a shock.
Not to me.
Right.
But it's shocking to people who think of Kennedy as the great American liberal.
Yeah, well, I think Kevin Phillips, Reagan's speechwriter, said it most aptly when he defined the Democratic Party as the capitalist second favorite party.
Yes, and you remember what the founder of the Labor Party, Tony Mazzocchi, once said. He said, the bosses have two political parties. Workers need one of their own.
I agree. I was at that conference in Cleveland years ago. And unfortunately, the Labor Party, after that, kind of fizzled. But, you know, they're running candidates in South Carolina. Did you know that?
Yes, I did. And they went through a petition process. I don't know how it turned out, but I suspect that that's a turnaround for them. I don't think the Labor Party can be the vehicle that we need. I think it could be part of the vehicle. I think there are forces in the Green Party that can be part of the vehicle. And so could people who are now working in the Democratic Party out of despair be part of that vehicle.
Absolutely. I think that even though the level of class consciousness in this country is really too low, and the consequent level of class organization, as you've been explaining, is very low. The United States working class has a history of explosive movement going all the way back to after the Civil War. The great tragedy would be if there's yet another explosion, and as sure as we're sitting here, I think there's going to be, that there's no leadership for it when it explodes.
Yeah, one of the things that the working class had after the Civil War is they had a Knights of Labor. And the thing about the Knights of Labor, which is the predecessor of the AFL, and the AFL actually was founded to destroy the Knights of Labor. The Knights of Labor admitted everybody who was a worker to their organization and organized on a city-by-city basis. They didn't organize primarily by industry. They didn't organize by trade, by craft. They were a union of all workers.
You think that if and when it comes here to the United States, that's the way our party is going to come through from one city to another or one region to another?
You know, in 1828, there were working men's parties in New York and Boston and Philadelphia. And the genius of Andrew Jackson was that he brought them into the Democratic Party. And we know that the populists were seduced back into the Democratic Party by William Jennings Bryan in 1896. And then you had John Kennedy brought people in at a point when everybody was desperate. But, you know, I think there are more people today that understand that that co-optation and that integration, we've had it once too often. And I think what's going to begin to happen is that in places like Minnesota, and maybe even New York City, and maybe New Jersey, and certainly in California, there are going to be people who are going to say, look, we've had it enough, and rather than waiting for a national party to emerge, they're going to start at the local level, which is what they did throughout history.
I agree with you. I think that's the way it's going to happen, too. And I think it's going to happen. I think that even the polls show that the majority of Americans are fed up with both parties. In fact, half the people don't even bother going out to vote.
That's right. It's 48% participate regularly in elections and 52% do not. Many of those people, we know who they are. They're young people. They're black people. They're women. They're Latinos. These are the people who are now moving outside of the electoral arena because they have no other alternative. And I think those are the people who are going to start to become the base of this new political formation. And one of the reasons they're going to become the base of it is that they are the most exploited and oppressed people in the country. I mean, they have less to lose by breaking from the two-party system. During the social welfare state where we had aid for families of dependent children, we gave people income if they were long-term unemployed and didn't require them to jump through hoops. There were a lot of people who were very poor who were sort of still attached to the New Deal and its successors, you know, attached to the state. And I think that's no longer as much the case. People don't have that much to lose anymore, and I think there's a certain sense that they have to get out in the streets and they got to start making their voices heard and protesting.
Stanley, how does that, though, then translate into actually a political party, into
electoralism?
Right. I mean, you were...
At the local level, I think it could translate tomorrow or maybe even yesterday. There's nothing, for example, in the 2005 mayoral election in New York City that commended anybody to really think that Fernando Ferrer was going to seriously challenge politically as well as ideologically and programmatically the Bloomberg administration.
He didn't even get the organized labor, really. I mean,
he didn't get a whole lot of people. Right. You know, he was a machine politician with a certain liberal glint at one point in his career who could not reach out and could not say the things that he needed to say. Let me give you an example. Our union, the Professional Staff Congress, of which I'm a member of the Executive Council, our union, Political Action Group, had him in an interview. They had breakfast with him one day, and they said, would you be in favor of the repeal of the Taylor Law, which forbids public employees from striking in New York State? That didn't. Transit workers, of course, found that that was one of the things that was hanging over their heads. He said, absolutely not. I'm not for the repeal of the Taylor Law. Public employees should not have the right to strike. Now, I mean, that's the Democratic Party in New York City at that point.
I mean, I have not a good word for, as someone who works on the issues I do, from torture to Guantanamo, we've been sold down the drain totally and completely by the Democrats. It's not even close.
Well, you've been down the drain is even worse than being sold down the river.
I know. But Stanley, I know you were going to, I mean, I heard you at the Left Forum, which you gave a brilliant speech about this. You're actually taking some steps on your own to do some of this, not on your own, but with some others.
The first thing that I did is I published a couple of pieces, and I'm coming out with a book, which is going to appear in September. I have attended a number of meetings, one of which was held in Washington for the creation of a new Center for Labor Renewal, which Bill Fletcher and Jerry Tucker put together. And those kinds of forums, these are rank-and-file people. These are not leadership of the top level. Some of them are local leaders. That's just one of the things that we're doing. The other thing we're going to start doing is, in New York pretty soon, is to form a study group around this question of new political formation. Study group will invite other people around the country to form study groups in Los Angeles and San Francisco and Chicago and Detroit and other places. And we suspect that a lot of people will do that. And the word study group is a very old way of starting an organization. It's a way of getting people together. They study and they talk about what their steps are at the local level. And one day down the road, hopefully, there would be a national conference and the assessment of whether people will actually be ready for some kind of an organization will have to be made. But I think what will happen if some of these groups blossom into local organizations is they may start actually to do some political organizing at the local level. Now, look, you said something about elections, but, you know, one of the things that a party could do, even before it was capable of contesting elections because of money, because of, well, not even because of money, but because of the number of people involved, is it could put out a weekly newspaper.
No, I agree with you. I actually don't go to elections right away. I didn't mean to imply that.
No, but it could put out a weekly newspaper, even at a national level, and then have local supplements. And those local supplements would deal with the local issues in places like New York, Detroit, Chicago, et cetera. But the national newspaper could be one, could be online as well as in hard copy, and could be offered on the street, would be one place where the connections that I talk about could be made on a regular basis.
Stanley, if people want information, where can they go? Is there a place on the web? Is there somewhere
I haven't. People want to begin to converse with me. My email number is saronowitz. Aronowitz, prefix S, as in Stanley, at igc.org. That's interglobalcommunication.org.
We know that one. It's the old PeaceNet that a few of us still have that code. I'm one, Stanley.
Michael. We're very grateful to have you on the program. You're a friend and a comrade. We'll be working with you and talking to you in the future. Thanks for being on Law & Disorder.
Bye now.
Thanks, Stanley. It's great.
I traveled round this country from shore to shining shore, and it really made me wonder the things I heard and saw. I saw the weary farmer plowing sod and loam. I saw the auction hammer, it was knocking down his home. But the banks are made of marble, with a guard at every door, and the vaults are stuffed with silver that the farmer sweated for.
I saw the seaman standing idly by the shore, and I heard bosses saying, got no work for you no more.
But the banks are made of marble, with a guard at every door, and the vaults are stuffed with silver that the seamen sweated for.
I saw the weary miner scrubbing coal dust from his back, and I heard his children crying, got no coal to heat the shack.
But the banks are made of marble, with a guard at every door, and the vaults are stuffed with silver that the miners sweated for. My brothers working throughout this mighty land, prayed we'd get together and together make a stand. Then we'd own those banks of marble, with a guard at every door, and we'd share those vaults of silver that we had sweated for.
We've all been hearing a lot about global warming, the melting Arctic, the effect on polar bears, etc. And of course, we all know the Bush administration has said there's no such thing, or if there is such thing, it's, quote, not our fault or not the fault of the United States. The United States has, of course, refused to support the Kyoto Accords, has refused to cut down on CO2 emissions, etc. Recently, of course, it's coming up much more, particularly people in the administration. Recently, our producer, Jeff Brady, went up to Albany, where there was a catastrophic climate change forum. Among the speakers at that forum were Dr. James Hansen, who's the director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies, has made a strong case for global warming, not in favor of it, but that it is going on, and that it is the product of emissions really caused from people, cars, etc.
If we stay on business as usual for the rest of this century, even the next half century, we will get warming of more than 2 degrees Celsius, so that the planet would be aiming toward a sea level rise of the order of 25 meters. The question is, how long would it take to get that? And it had been assumed in the last IPCC report, for example, that it takes millennia for the ice sheets to respond. But that's based on the past changes of the ice sheets, which tended to go along with the slow forcings that occur on the natural paleoclimate timescales. The ice sheets, the forcings change very slowly, and they're very extremely weak. It's mostly feedbacks that are occurring. And on those timescales, the ice sheet response time can be 1,000 years or even 2,000 years. But with the rate of change of the human-made forcing, the response time cannot be more than 2 or 3 centuries. We don't have models capable of representing the ice sheet process because it's a wet process. Ice sheet growth is a dry process limited by the rate of snowfall on the ice sheet. But the disintegration of an ice sheet is a wet process, which can occur much more rapidly and explosively once it reaches a certain stage. You get melt on the surface of the ice sheet, and this is a hole in the Greenland ice sheet, and the water goes down, tunnels down to the base of the ice sheet, and there it lubricates the ice sheet, and the ice then moves because of that. Could I have the next one, please? The area in which we're getting summer melt on the ice sheets is increasing. This compares 1992 and 2002. And 2005, could I have the next one, had even a larger area of melting. The regions with dark red dots had melt last year for the first time. As the Greenland is getting warmer, the area of melt is increasing. And then as a result, the ice streams which carry icebergs out to the ocean have been increasing. This is the biggest ice stream on Greenland, and its speed has doubled in the last 5 years. The other large ice streams have also increased at comparable rates. As a result, we now, just in the last 3 years, we have this spectacular satellite called GRACE, which is a gravity satellite, which measures the gravity field of the Earth with such precision that you can measure the mass of the Greenland ice sheet and the Antarctic ice sheet. And what is found is that the mass of Greenland is decreasing. In the last year, it decreased by 200 cubic kilometers, which is 50 cubic miles. So it's as if you have a cube 1 mile on a side and 1 mile high. 50 of those melted in this last year. Well, if you spread that around the world ocean, it's only 0.5 millimeter of sea level rise, or five centimeters in a century. But the rate at which that is occurring is rapidly increasing. This is a graph of glacial earthquakes. You have seismometers located around the world, and when an earthquake occurs, you can the seismometers register that there's an earthquake, and you can, because you have many different seismometers, you can tell exactly where it came from. And what they've discovered is in the last several years is that there are earthquakes on Greenland. And what those earthquakes are is the when that water lubricates the base of the ice sheet enough, it'll suddenly move forward and then stop again. You know, it runs in the ground and stops. But that registered as an earthquake with a magnitude between 4.6 and 5.1, and those ice quakes are occurring right at the places where the ice is being discharged as icebergs into the ocean. The amount of these ice quakes doubled between the early 1990s and the late 1990s, and then it's doubled again. Last year was 4 times what it was a decade or so earlier. And the flux of water going to the ocean is increasing as this happens. Could I have the next one, please? So let's think about what would a 25-meter sea level rise imply.
This is New York City area. Manhattan is down here. GWB is the George Washington Bridge. So you can see there's still a little bit of land that would be above water by the George Washington Bridge. But Long Island has become Short Island. And next one is Washington, I think, where the White House would be under several meters of water. And and the next one, okay, this shows the, again, this is for the 25-meter change in sea level. You can see that Florida is mostly underwater. A lot of cities along the East Coast would be underwater, as well as Louisiana and Texas. China, Shanghai, and their large populated regions that would be underwater. In India, Bangladesh would be underwater. So this is the population chart, and it turns out that half the people in the world live within 50 miles of the coastline. You can see that the population density in Bangladesh and India and China is very high near the coastlines. And if we just take the product of the sea level rise, so what would be the population underwater? With 25 meters of sea level rise, the east coast of the United States is 41 million people. In Bangladesh, the population is 137 million, but 109 million would be underwater, so most of the country would be underwater. Even a place like Japan, which is a mountainous island, has 39 million people underwater. So you're talking a huge change, and this the thing about sea level rise, if we really go for this business as usual so that we head the planet in that direction, what would happen is this century we would probably get, at the beginning, the change is slow. But because of these multiple positive feedbacks, it's a very nonlinear process. And when it starts to go faster, we know that sea level goes up rapidly. When we came out of the last ice age, sea level 14,000 years ago, during Meltwater Pulse 1A, sea level went up 20 meters in 400 years. So that's 5 meters a century, and that's 1 meter every 20 years. My guess would be that if we take a business as usual scenario, that we would get 2 or 3 meters of sea level rise this century. And next century, we would get a lot more than that. Sea level is one big issue. Another issue is what I call extermination of species, which is also sometimes called decrease in biological diversity, but that's sort of a euphemism. This is an email that I got a few weeks ago from somebody in Arkansas who said, wanted to tell me about an observation that he had noticed. He said, the observation is the armadillo. I had not seen one of these animals my entire life until the last 10 years. I drive the same 40-mile trip on the same road every day and have slowly watched these critters advance further north every year for the last 10 years, and they are not stopping. Well, that's an expected, the distribution of plants and animals is a different way of defining climate. They follow the distributions of climate. So if climate changes, the plants and animals attempt to migrate. But some of them can migrate more easily than others.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. Law and Disorder is produced by Jeff Brady. The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.
Me and my wife run all over town. Everywhere we go, the people would turn us down, Lord, and the bridge rolls down. Down. I got the bourgeois blues, gonna spread in news all around. Me and Martin, we were standing upstairs. I heard a white man say, I don't want no niggas up there. Lord, he's a bourgeois man. He's a bourgeois town. Bourgeois blues gonna spread in you all around. brave, land of the free. I don't want to be mistreated by no bourgeoisie, Lord, in a bourgeois town. It's a bourgeois town. I got the bourgeois blues are gonna spread the news all around. Town. I got the bourgeois blues and I'm so gonna spread the news.